Miami is more than a hotspot for COVID-19, making it increasingly doubtful school buildings will reopen next month for students and teachers. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. The warning from doctors this week, Miami is where China was several months ago as the global pandemic began.
Miami's now the epicenter of the pandemic. What we were seeing in Wuhan 6 months ago, 5 months ago, now we are there.
With infection rates high, cases growing, it is increasingly unlikely school buildings will reopen next month.
We will not risk exposing our students and staff until the coronavirus is under control.
We'll hear more from the superintendent of Broward Schools later on this hour. Your phone calls in the South Florida Roundup next, made possible by Willie the Bee Man, bee removal specialist. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening this week and supporting public radio. South Florida, Broward, Miami-Dade, Monroe, and Palm Beach counties make up about half the COVID-19 cases in Florida. Hospitalizations have been increasing substantially in South Florida. ICU bed capacity is close to maxing out here and across the rest of the state. So let's talk about the COVID-19 response here in July and the week that was, and what may be coming for South Florida. Taking your phone calls, are you a healthcare worker on a COVID floor in a hospital? What have you been experiencing? Have you waited in those long lines hoping for a COVID test? What are your thoughts about wearing masks and maintaining social distancing? How about schools possibly reopening online in the weeks ahead? What about going back to work or having to continue to work during COVID-19? 800-743-WLRN. Our toll-free phone number open right now as we're live in the 1 o'clock hour on this Friday afternoon. 800-743-9576. You could also send us a tweet, our handle on Twitter, at WLRN. WLRN's healthcare reporter Veronica Zaragovia joins us via FaceTime audio. Veronica, a lot of statistics to get to on this Friday, but instead of starting with the infection rate, let's talk about hospitalization and utilization of intensive care unit beds. What does the latest data tell us about how many folks are in the hospital and the capacity of the healthcare system here in South Florida to deal with the continued surge?
Well, thank you, Tom, for having me on. The last 4 days or so, the number of COVID-19 admitted patients in Miami-Dade County has kind of plateaued a little bit. And so officials are saying that they're able to manage with either converting ICU converting beds for COVID patients or converting units in hospitals into COVID-19 units. So at this point, they're handling the bed situation, and their concern at the moment, the more pressing concern, is the staff.
Mm-hmm. And talk to us about what those concerns are. How are those concerns manifesting? Is it is it staff getting ill? Is it just the number of staff members necessary to deal with the surge?
It's a bit of all of it, because mm-hmm. COVID-19 patients require a lot of people on hand, and Jackson Health System is reporting about 200 staff members who have become infected with the coronavirus. And they tell me it's not because of their work, but because they've been infected in the community. So everybody's feeling a bit frustrated with either a lack of mask enforcement or people not wearing them because people are getting ill outside of work. And so the state has contracted with many nurses for Jackson, and particularly they're sending 100 to help them with either those who are out sick or those who just need a break. They've been doing this for 5 months, more or less.
Bringing in these traveling nurses a little bit for relief, but also to staff up as they open up new bed space for these COVID patients, as well as others that in the community still need health care.
Correct. And this is a statewide a possibility to receive nurses. And then the state would eventually try to get compensation from FEMA for those nurses.
3 months or so ago, we saw a large tent being erected in the fairgrounds in Miami-Dade County near FIU. We saw the convention space in Miami Beach being converted, both into field hospitals. What's the status of those facilities? Are they being reactivated?
So the one at the fairgrounds has been dismantled, and they could set it up again, but it's not there at the moment. And the one at the convention center is there, but remember that because that's in an evacuation zone, as we're in the middle of hurricane season, that's complicated, but there are no patients in there right now. And then the one that there is another, they've converted the former Pan American Hospital right by the airport into, it's now called the Miami Care Center. And that one is specifically for patients who have, who are positive with COVID-19, but they no longer need hospital level care. Mm-hmm. And they live normally at nursing homes or those types of facilities. And before they go back home, they need a place to recover. So that opens up beds at the hospital.
Yeah, tell us a little bit more about the state of nursing homes, what we can tell from the state data here locally in this vulnerable population.
That's a topic I look at a lot. I mean, for one thing, the state is requiring staff to test every 2 weeks. And one thing with the staff is that they earn, some certified nursing assistants in Florida earn less than $12 an hour, more or less $12 an hour. So a lot of them have to work in many facilities. And unfortunately, that's led to a lot of risk when it comes to getting an infection. But and actually, it used to be in Florida the case that the majority of people who were getting infected with COVID-19 were at nursing homes, and that's now dropped to a little around half or a little beneath that. And they are taking patients, once they have to go to a hospital, they are being taken to these what are called isolation centers. And what I'm looking at is a bit of concern that some of these temporary places where people are recovering are places that haven't shown through data to have the disease under control. I mean, double digit infections or deaths. And one of them in particularly in Boca has been fined more than $74,000by CMS, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid in D.C. And so I'm just concerned about how these patients will be doing there.
Veronica Zaragovia is the WLRN healthcare reporter. Veronica, stick with us. Talking about COVID-19 here in South Florida, 800-743-9576. Maybe you've waited in line to get that nasal swab. What was that experience like? Perhaps you have a loved one in an assisted living facility or nursing home. What are those experiences like? 800-743-9576. Or on Twitter at WLRN. Enrique in Miami is up first. Enrique, go ahead. You are on the radio.
Hi, how are you doing?
Thanks for calling in. Your thoughts?
Well, my thoughts are just disbelief on the travesty that we're having from our politicians. I think the big mess that we are is thanks to the irresponsibility in our politicians, basically. You know, having miscommunication, misinformation coming from the top to the bottom is what led us where we are right now. There's no way that we can open anything safely until we have everything in place. Everything meaning we need to have most definitely our testing in place on a way that we can have a turnaround on less than 48 hours. We need to have a positivity on the test to be less than 5%. If we don't get to those numbers, we should be in lockdown completely, 100%. That's what happened in every single country, every single community that successfully overcame this virus. If we don't have those in place, we cannot have anything open. It's just unbelievable to have the governor saying that if we can go to Home Depot, we can go back to school. You go to Home Depot for 5 minutes, for an hour the most, wearing masks, keeping distance, adults. You're talking about sending my child for 5 days, 4 or 5 hours on a day with a bunch of kids that don't know how to behave, and they're just kids. There's no way. There was no way that we're not going to have a massive, massive transmission if we open schools again.
Enrique, I hear the frustration and the growing anxiety and concern, and I appreciate you listening and sharing your perspective with us here on the South Florida Roundup. Thanks for calling in. Dr. Cheryl Holder is with us. She's been watching all of this as a public health professional, medical professional. She is the president of the Florida State Medical Association and a professor at Florida International University's Medical School. Dr. Holder, welcome to the South Florida Roundup. What would you say to Enrique in Miami and the frustration and anxiety you heard in his voice?
Yeah, I definitely understand fully what's going on in our society and right now being frustrated and wishing our leadership would stand up and be consistent in the messaging. And it is difficult because now we have varying municipalities making different recommendations, which leads to further confusion, and where the science is clearly pointing out that the only real way to flatten the curve again is to decrease exposure to others who may be infected. Now, how are you going to do that? That's what folks won't want to willingly say, wear masks, each of us wear masks, each of us stay apart from each other, avoiding closed areas. When I do my patients in clinic, I am not walking around talking. I have on a mask, I have on a face shield, and I'm standing 6 feet away and I'm seeing a patient. So, and that's what will hopefully keep me and everyone else from getting infected.
Dr. Holder, one of those
what we know work.
And one of those other protocols that is back on the table is some kind of stay-at-home guidance, if not a stay-at-home order. Veronica Zaragovia, our healthcare reporter at WLR, and the Miami mayor, Francis Suarez, put that squarely back in play this week in a very vocal way, didn't he?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they want to understand if they all have to be on the, you know, if they're all going to be on the same page when it comes to enforcing masks and taking the measures that it would take for this, for the numbers to start decreasing. They would want maybe some, I think they're pushing for Governor DeSantis to mandate masks across the state.
Yeah. Dr. Holder, tell us the measures that you spoke about and the measures that we've seen exercised by political leaders. Is a new stay-at-home order or at least stay-at-home guidance something that ought to be put in place? And if so, what's the trigger infection rate or hospitalization number that you'd be suggesting?
Well, Based on what we did the first time, the numbers are now worse. And the first time we put it in place and we saw the flattening of the curve, the reopening did not follow CDC guidelines, and the community was not fully educated on the importance of the steps to maintain the decreased transmission. And there was a sense that it wasn't such a big deal. So we have to understand how we got here. And so there's the blame all around, but also a lack of our ability to transmit the information clearly. Guidance, whatever we call, people have to understand that the more I stay away from others, the greater my chances are of not getting infected.
Do we still have an opportunity as a community in South Florida with the infection rates and the trends that we've seen to contain the virus?
Definitely, we have to find a way to be strong enough that whether there's a guidance or not, we understand that that is the only way to get back in control, or else we'll face September, October, this will continue. If we don't do something drastic to decrease our exposure and infection, we're going to end up with 175% or more of us will get infected because it's that easy to spread. So as a community, we have to understand that the only way to decrease infection is to decrease my chances of meeting somebody who's going to infect me. How is that? Stay home unless you absolutely have to go out. If you absolutely have to go out, use your mask, wear, protect your eyes, and stand 6 feet away. And we do this together over time. We will be able to control the epidemic. We did it before. It was clear that it was happening. It happened in New York. It happened in Miami earlier in March. We saw the decline.
In Italy.
When we went back out. And it happened in Italy. It's happening in New Zealand.
Yeah.
These are standard epidemiologic methods that has worked. It worked with typhoid. It worked with the flu, 1918. It works. But we have to understand and respect the science and say, we're going to do this together.
Dr. Holder, stick with us here.
Under control.
Dr. Cheryl Holder is with us from Florida International University. Stay with us here on the South Florida Roundup. Veronica Zaragovia, our healthcare reporter here at WLRN. Stick with us as well. Next up, testing and tracing, how far that has gone in slowing the spread of COVID-19. What's necessary in order to slow down the surge that South Florida has been experiencing? That's next with your phone calls, 800-743-9576. 800-743-WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. Hard Rock Stadium in Miami Gardens has lines of cars and trucks and SUVs that remind you of a Dolphin game or a Hurricane game, right? The stadium, no, is not hosting football. Instead, it's operating a drive-through coronavirus testing site, and it could take hours to get swabbed. In response, the state launched a new lane, a few lanes here, just for folks showing symptoms, actively showing symptoms. People have responded, waiting several days to hear whether they're positive for COVID-19. Your experience here as we talk about testing and tracing the coronavirus in South Florida, 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Venetia in Coral Springs, you're up next. Venetia, thanks for holding on. You have been through one of these lines for testing, is that right?
Yes, I have, and it wasn't so bad. The only thing I would recommend is you go with a full tank of gas, and you stay in line, and you just do what you need to do. I spent about 2.5 hours online at the Tamarack Recreation Center. Mm-hmm. And the test was done 1, 2, 3, and I got my results back in 2 to 3 days. I didn't have to wait 7 to 8 days for my test results, and it was free.
And this was the nasal swab, Venetia?
The nasal swab, yes, and it was fine, not a problem. And I found this through the county's Broward County website, mm-hmm. and it lists all the places that you can go for a test. Some of them do cost money. Some of them do require a referral from your primary care physician. But this one was free.
You had no referral. You didn't have to make an appointment. You showed up, got the car in line, and waited.
Right.
Okay.
It's offered Tuesday, Wednesdays, and Thursdays from 9 until 3. So I got there at about 12 o'clock, and I was done by 2.
And you waited 2-3 days, and you got your test results?
Yes, it was. Now that I'm looking, it was 3 days.
3 days. Venetia, thanks for sharing your experience with us there from Coral Springs. 800-743-9576. Dr. Cheryl Holder with us from FIU. Dr. Holder, Venetia's experience somewhat atypical from what we've heard and seen, those helicopter local television news video shots of lines of cars in Miami Gardens, around Hard Rock Stadium, around Marlins Park. What do you make of kind of the state of testing right now in South Florida?
Again, that's another area that we wish there was more urgency in understanding and implementing the epidemiological steps. Testing, tracking, and containing is the next step after you flatten the curve. 14 days, no infection, you're going back out, reopening. That should be everywhere without waiting hours. Time of 9 to 3 also is not the greatest for people. Yeah. The community I serve that work in a lot of these jobs that mm-hmm. can't take off, there's no nighttime testing. They won't be able to go from 9 to 3. There's no early morning, so they can go before they get to work.
And a number of testing facilities don't accept children, anyone under the age of 18, for instance.
Don't accept children.
Yeah.
Right. And even to still require referral is a little difficult when you have a large percentage of uninsured, which we have in Miami.
Yes, we do.
So there are a lot of barriers still to rapid access to testing. The turnaround time of 2 to 3 days is much improved. 7 days is not good because then you've spread it all over the place.
Yeah. Veronica Zaragovia, we've heard those stories of folks waiting 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 days, for instance, for test results.
Exactly. And by that point, they, you know, some of them also don't have symptoms. So then they're not sure if they're supposed, they feel they were exposed to someone, so they get tested, but then they don't know if they're supposed to be staying at home for 2 weeks or can they go to work. So that's, one of the problems.
Michael in Davie on line four. Go ahead, Michael. You're up next.
Yes, I run a small assisted living facility in Broward County. We just started using the oral curative testing for the staff members of the facility and find it to be a lot easier and more friendly than the nasal testing.
Describe that test for us. Describe that. How do you take that test? Is that just a cheek swab from the inside of your mouth?
Yes, it's a cheek swab. They ask that you swab both of your cheeks, your lower gums, your upper gums, your under your tongue and your actual tongue itself and put it in a beaker, in a tube, in a testing tube with some liquid.
And how long for results, Mike?
They're saying actually 2 to 3 days, so we're hoping the two-day turnaround is good.
Michael and Davey, thanks for sharing that with us. Dr. Holder, how about that swab test versus the PCR nasal swab?
The data on those are good when they're collected correctly. And so there's a little bit higher false negative, and it's probably related to collecting because it's layperson's collecting, and you really do have to follow the direction.
Yeah, but what do you think about that self-swab, the self-swab test?
It's better for most part. It's better than not getting tested, mm-hmm. and the new studies are coming up much better. There's one that really has a lot of potential. That's what we call a point of care, and that sensitivity specificity of that test, it's coming out to be pretty good as the PCR that goes in the back of your nose.
What's a point of care test? Is that?
That means you get the result back within the 30 minutes there.
Yeah.
So you don't, that's the ideal for testing, tracking, containing, so that you can educate easily.
Dr. Holder, let me take another quick call here from Rose in Pembroke Pines. She wants to share her testing experience with us. Go ahead, Rose. You're on the radio.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Hi, Dr. Holder.
Hi.
This is Rose Williams. How are you?
Oh, hi. So, how are you?
I am good. So I am telling the gentleman that what we're seeing at our office is patient just walking in and thinking that they can get tested in a physician's office. And even though we screen them on the phone, some of them think they can just walk in. So the information is not correct. These patients are not being told that physicians are not given this test. And so they pose a risk to us when they walk in because some of them will have symptoms. And thank God the physicians are very careful in wearing their masks and their gloves and their shields. So I think the information is not getting to the public correctly.
Rose, I appreciate you sharing that experience. You work in a doctor's office, primary care physician, is that right?
Yes, yes.
Tell us if you would like to share with us just your experience of patients and their behavior about protocols and masks and social distancing. Is everybody behaving when they come into the office?
Well, they have no choice. We have you cannot come in without a mask. We try to screen you without. We have a testing questionnaire. And there are those who come in and try to tell me, they try to put the mask on, but they don't have it covered over their nose, and you cannot come into my office because I can see you from a distance.
Yeah.
And I don't take the excuse that I have an allergy. If you have an allergy, you can't come into my office. You have to have your face covered. And, you know, so, you know, 99.9% of our patients, they comply. But there's always that, you know, that small percentage that don't want to comply. So, unfortunately, if you do not want to comply, you don't come to my office.
You're like a bouncer, aren't you, Rose, in that doctor's office now?
You have to be.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you're at risk. The patients are at risk. Now, as a primary, you don't see patient like in the old days, every 15 minutes. It's one every 45 minutes.
Yeah.
Okay?
Rose,
so
I appreciate you
no
sharing your experience with us. Sorry to interrupt. I wanted to grab one more call. From Pembroke
Thank
Pines.
You
Take
so
care
much.
Of yourself and
day.
Your colleagues. Sure, you too. Yvette in Miami has a blood test experience she wants to share with us. Yvette, you're on the radio. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. My name is Yvette, and I'm calling you from Miami, Florida. And I just wanted to share, I basically had a test about 3 weeks ago. I noticed one of the labs diagnostic centers were offering it. You have either LabCorp or Quest. So I got an email on that, and so then I basically made an appointment. I contacted my physician. Yes, you probably would need insurance. You could obviously pay for it, but in this case, you know, my insurance would cover it. But I had to contact my physician. My physician sent the requisition to Quest Diagnostics, and my appointment, I went in. They basically had a lot of individuals just wanting to walk in, but they will not take you on a walk-in basis. Mm-hmm. You have to have an appointment. And I was in and out of there once my appointment was ready, and I got my results the very next day.
If you are comfortable sharing with us, why did you opt for the blood test?
I was more curious because I know that I don't know where I could get one immediately for, you know, the nose testing. And quite frankly, I know people do it, and I'm not trying to downplay or anything like that. I just can't see myself sitting online for 2 hours to get a test result. Obviously I don't have symptoms, you know, I wouldn't have symptoms.
Fair enough. Yvette, thanks for sharing that experience with us. Juan in Hollywood, I've got about just 1 minute left. Go ahead.
Hello?
Juan, you're on the radio. I got about a minute.
Okay. I just wanted to say that Monday, it'll mark 3 weeks since I got tested at Hard Rock, and I still have not gotten my results.
Dr. Holder, what's the advice to Juan? 3 weeks and waiting for a result.
Your specimen is lost. They're usually very good in a week. You should go back and repeat for asymptomatic carrier. One thing, people are doing blood tests. The blood test checks for antibodies.
Yeah.
That doesn't tell you if you're now infected. It tells you if you were infected in the past and was able to mount a response.
Dr. Holder, we got to leave it there, but we do appreciate your time. Thanks so much for some office hours here on the South Florida Roundup. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Dr. Cheryl Holder with Florida International University. Veronica Zaragovia, WLRN's healthcare reporter. Thanks for your time, Veronica. We're back on the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening this week. Nearly a third of kids in Florida have tested positive for the coronavirus since the beginning of the pandemic. They typically don't show symptoms, but there are worries about what that could mean in the long term. Palm Beach County's health director, Dr. Alina Alonzo, warned county commissioners about the issue, saying x-rays have shown lung damage in some kids in Miami and other parts of the country.
We don't know how that's going to manifest a year from now or 2 years from now. Is that child going to have chronic pulmonary problems or not? So this is not the virus that you bring everybody together to make sure you catch and get it over with.
Meantime, the debate over reopening schools continues here in South Florida. The Palm Beach School Board voted to start the school year fully online. A specific start date, however, remains up in the air. Miami-Dade Schools will revisit its plan later this month. Broward County Superintendent of Schools Robert Runcie recommended this week to go fully online. Here's what he said in a video statement on Tuesday.
We will never be able to open our buildings until we have decreased and leveled the number of COVID-19 cases.
I spoke with Superintendent Runcie via Skype about the district's reopening plans. Superintendent Runcie, welcome back to WLRN. When you said you won't open buildings until there's a drop and a steady number of infections, what kind of statistics do you have in mind?
We are using a framework that's developed by the CDC, looking at our county metrics. And in fact, we're going to go into some detail on that at our next school board workshop on our reopening strategies. But there's probably a handful of metrics that we will continue to look at, including infection rates, hospitalization numbers, you know, and so those are some of the things that we look at, as well as where things are with district staff as well.
So to give us an idea of infection rate, is it something below 10% that you're targeting? And if so, for how long?
So what we would target is probably 5% or lower in Broward County right now. Given the conversation we had recently with our public health officials, we are in excess of 16%. That has to drop in a significant way. Just give you another point of reference. New York, which is one point, was the epicenter. Their rate now is down to 2%. Again, we're 16. I understand that Miami-Dade might be somewhere near 25. So Florida is really in a bad spot. All the trend numbers that we've received from our public health officials are going in the wrong direction. And you can't open schools without taking the community context and what's going on there into consideration. And that's absolutely what we're doing. It's the right thing to do. And we have to make sure that however we open our schools, it has to be done in a way that's safe, not only for our students, but our employees. You know, we've got about 30,000 employees. We're the largest employer in the county.
Mr. Superintendent, let me ask you just to be clear here on this 5% number. That would be the daily infection rate for how long, an average of how many days, in order for you to feel comfortable to open up the schoolhouse, the school buildings again?
Well, again, so that's a trend number that we will work with our public health department, but it would have to be a number that we would see for some period of time. Whether it be a week or a few days, we'll get that determination shortly from working with our health officials. But it's not just a number we just get one day and we use that. We need to see a consistent trend and a pattern, right?
And it is substantially lower than what the numbers have been for many, many weeks in Broward County. With that 5% threshold, it sounds like Broward County parents and teachers and students may be prepared for online learning for many weeks, if not months.
It is absolutely possible that that would be the case. But I will tell you that just, you know, a few weeks ago, we were prepared and were planning to open the school year with a variety of hybrid models, including allowing parents who elect to have their kids go full time every day. We believe we were going to be able to accommodate the majority of those type of requests. But as you know, how things have continued to evolve, every week looks very different than the prior week.
Those hybrid models are off the table, though, right now for the first few weeks of school. Is that fair to say?
Yes, they are.
You mentioned also hospitalizations as a metric that you're watching. We've seen a significant uptick in hospitalization utilization in Broward County as well as ICUs. Give us a sense of what number you're looking for to feel comfortable to open up the school doors again.
Yeah, what I would say is I don't have a number that I can give you at this moment. I think we're doing a number of things this week. Consulting with our local health officials. Number two, I've asked three national organizations, including the Council of Great City Schools, which represents the 70 largest school systems, the Chiefs for Change, which also represents a variety of chiefs that run state agencies as well as superintendents, as well as finally the Florida Association of District School Superintendents to get a sense, hey, what kind of gating measures is everyone using, and try to get a sense from that as we begin to develop our own numbers to get some comfort level there. And finally, we have McKinsey, who's been working with us, and we're asking them to go and gather some data as well.
McKinsey is the international consulting firm, but you expect to come back with some kind of threshold of hospitalization utilization that you feel comfortable with as superintendent?
Yes, we intend to come back with a handful of metrics that we will utilize, metrics that are consistent with the framework from the CDC. And then what we will do then is actually put some quantifiable numbers on those and share those with the public. So it's not going to be some random subjective thing we're going to do. Obviously, we're going to rely on the science. We're going to make sure that whatever we come up with seems reasonable to our public health officials, and then we'll go from there.
You mentioned 5% in terms of a daily infection rate that has averaged over a certain number of days. You're anchoring expectations in the community by saying that publicly. How anchored are you to that 5% number?
I'm not fully anchored to that. That's a number I know as we begin to survey folks around the country. That's a number that has come up in a number of areas as school districts consider where they are. But again, you know, we were higher than that when we were planning to open in a hybrid mode. So again, we're still trying to figure out what that is. I wouldn't say that's in our official final number. We're not anchored to it. I was given that as kind of an example. I can tell you it's not 16% and it's not 2%. We're going to find some reasonable number there? Because, look, we got to get our kids back in school. We all know the challenges that our kids and our families are having by them not being in school. So that's our goal. And I continue to plead with our community for everyone to take all the necessary measures so that collectively, as a community, we can get our infection rates down and get this pandemic and the numbers going in the right direction so we can open our schools and get our kids and teachers back together again.
We're speaking with Broward County Superintendent of Schools, Robert Runcie, about reopening schools. He recommended this week that students and staff start the school year in Broward County fully online because of the high numbers of coronavirus cases in South Florida, particularly in Broward County. Superintendent, Florida law gives local school districts and school boards the final authority to make decisions, including reopening. State education leaders have issued a directive to reopen schools this fall 5 days a week, school buildings 5 days a week, if they can, based upon local health directives. Are you feeling pressure from state regulators to open up before the infection numbers are at a level where your public health advisors are advising?
No, I mean, the only pressure I'm feeling is from the state of the coronavirus pandemic in our community. That's what I'm watching. That's what I'm concerned about. We have to do the right thing by our students, our staff. We've got to make sure when we reopen, we don't put ourselves in a situation where within a few weeks after that, we've got to go shut down again and go through some roller coaster of opening, reopening. That will be enormously problematic. And so, the state, in my understanding, has given, and especially in South Florida, they know our circumstances are significantly different. I believe we'll have some flexibility. We will be submitting a plan to the state at the end of this month, letting them know how we intend to open, the rationale behind it, and our plan to move to the next phase, what that would look like. So I'm hopeful that at some point in the near future, this school year, that our conditions in South Florida, in particular Broward County, will improve such that we can open our school doors more fully to our students.
One of the concerns that we've heard voiced by local officials over the past couple of weeks is that back in April and May, there was a lot of planning about how to reopen, but there was no planning about retreating if we saw infection spikes. Part of the plan that you're putting together, will there be a retreat plan should we see a resurgence of the virus in the fall?
Yes, absolutely. And that is part of our strategy. And we started our strategy from the very beginning with the understanding that we would develop different reopening strategies based on where conditions are in the community. And so we go from worst case, which is 100% online, to a variety of hybrid models, and then obviously reopen in our district fully.
Superintendent Runcie, what will be different for the online learning experience for students this fall that'll be different from what they experienced in the springtime?
That is our big, big focus over the next few weeks, and it has been so far over the summer break. We learned a lot over the past 3 months from our teachers, our parents, and the feedback we've received from them, as even well as our students. And so we're using that experience to significantly enhance and improve the quality of the e-learning experience. Our teachers are receiving extensive additional training on tools and strategies that they can utilize to be more effective in engaging our students. And so the expectation is, and I think parents will see it, that the e-learning experience is going to be very different. There's been a lot of conversation about instances where there wasn't video chatting going on, for example. It's going to be our expectation that is just a part of the instruction that parents will see.
Teachers to have their web cameras on then.
That's correct. That's where a big part of the challenge came in. Let me just say this. I really believe we have some of the best teachers, not in the country, but the world here in Broward County. And we were fortunate that when we went into this shutdown, that the majority of our teachers had already been working in a blended learning environment for at least 3 years. The district had invested millions of dollars in creating a learning management system.
Is blended, you mean some online learning, even if it's in the classroom?
That is correct. And that had been going on in the district with the majority of our teachers. What we had to do at that point for the majority of teachers, we just needed to make sure that our kids had access to devices. They had access to internet connectivity because many of our teachers were comfortable as they moved there. Now, that wasn't every teacher, right? So many people saw significant differences in their experiences. So our goal and what we're doing now is making sure that there's a consistent level of experience and expectation for all teachers as they go online. I think, I know we're going to do a significantly better job with that this year, and parents will see that. And we're going to provide some visual explanations of what that might look like for parents, our school board, and the public within the next several days.
Superintendent Runcie, we got a text from a listener this week. Nympha in Broward County wrote us saying, as a classroom teacher, I am afraid. I'm afraid for myself, my students, and everyone else who works inside of the school facility and the people who might visit or who might have business there on any particular day. How do you work toward addressing those fears and ensuring the safe return of students as you look at the health metrics in the weeks ahead?
I think number one is that we are always putting the health and safety of our students and our teachers at the forefront. Secondly, we're following the guidelines that have been prescribed by CDC, public health experts, medical experts. We're making sure that we have enhanced cleaning protocols that we put in place, safety measures that we are requiring. So the plans that we put together, for example, required all students, all staff, everyone in our facilities to be wearing masks. That's a requirement. Of course, everything from, you know, hand washing, sanitation, restructuring just about every function we have in the district, from transportation to food service. Obviously, we can't have kids congregating in the cafeteria now for lunch. We have to figure out some other protocol where they may have to grab a lunch, eat in the classroom or some other space where we can maintain safety requirements. So there's a lot that we're putting in place that we're going to be demonstrating to our teachers, to our parents, to all of our employees, hey, that it's safe to be on a campus, that we're taking all the measures that we can to make sure that the environment continues to be clean and safe for all of you. And that's what we've got to do. We'll never obviously be 100%, but we need to be at a place where we have confidence that if we do these things and if people follow them, then they're going to be okay.
Mr. Superintendent, in our final moments here, a bit of a lightning round. Let me ask you a series of really short questions that I'm sure are weighing on the minds of parents and teachers and faculty members and community members. When it comes to the online learning strategy, is the school day going to be the clock that students and teachers are still expected to follow?
Yes, we're creating a structured schedules that would mirror what we would have in brick and mortar, and that's going to be for elementary, middle, and high school. We have to do that in order to create some structure around what we're doing. And by the way, when we do that, that makes it a lot easier for us when the time comes to transition to opening up our campuses, because that schedule will remain.
The teachers who will be teaching online, will those be entirely Broward County Public School teachers?
Yes. I mean, the teachers that we have, they will be our teachers that will be delivering instruction. One of the things I would say is that we have a number of instructional individuals who are not assigned to classrooms. For example, coaches, instructional facilitators. We may further assign those individuals to classrooms so that we can expand our capacity to create innovative schedules. So, for example, we know that there are some parents who need to be with their young children when they are getting online. So we're considering having evening portions of our classes so that we can accommodate the schedule of parents.
Evening portion, meaning like 6, 7, 8 o'clock at night for a second grade math class?
Yeah, so we would have students who would, let's say, have classes from, 8 o'clock to, go all the way to maybe 2. And then we would have another set that may start later in the day, like 4 or 5 o'clock, go into the evening. There are going to be situations where the parent needs to be engaged and participating along with their child. That's what they desire. So we're looking at ways in which we can allocate staff and be able to satisfy that type of request from some of our parents.
What about food service at schools for those who qualify during online instruction?
Yeah, we are still going to have to maintain our feeding sites and figure out some ways to make sure that we can get lunches delivered to students. When we had the shutdown, we had 51 sites open. We had a couple days during the week where parents could pick up meals that would last them for the entire week. So that's one model we could use. We also have the possibility of leveraging our transportation fleet to potentially go and help deliver meals as well. So there's a number of options, but hey, our students need to be able to get access to healthy meals. That's a priority that will occur. And we'll just make sure that we find creative ways to get it to them.
How about fall athletics, Superintendent?
Yeah, so our plan is to certainly have athletics. We're working with the State Athletic Association monitoring what is going on with everyone from professional sports to collegiate sports. It was our intention to actually start up some of our sports programs this week with strength training and some of those things that we could kind of manage and do physical distancing in. We've postponed those and we're looking at the situation on a week by week basis. But it's my hope that we may be able to find a way to accommodate some aspects of our athletic programs.
Will that be a sport by sport decision?
Yeah, it would have to be a sport by sport, right? I mean, football looks totally different than golf or tennis. So we're going to have to evaluate what that looks like. And so our athletic department is going through that. So I'm hopeful that we'll be able to engage some of our sports. Others are going to be a little bit more of a challenge. And hopefully we'll be able to get some of those things going by the start of the school year. Our athletics, our band programs, our chorus, all of these activities, they're what our kids live for. They create culture and community at our schools. They're extremely important, and we want to make sure we get those off the ground as well.
Mr. Superintendent is a longtime trombone player and marching band and jazz band. Thank you for mentioning band. Appreciate that in that context. We have to leave it there. Superintendent Robert Runcie, the head of schools at Broward County. Thank you, sir.
All right. Thank you, Tom.
WLRN asked listeners about their thoughts on schools this fall as the coronavirus pandemic continues. On Facebook, Heather posted that she was considering homeschooling. She wrote, "The government doesn't care about the safety of my children, so it looks like I have to take matters into my own hands for schooling now as well." Nordia Ramirez commented, "I say open schools, but keep them disinfected with additional janitors and resources. Students should wear masks, practice social distancing, and if your child is sick, they should stay home." We also heard from Ricky in Miami.
Hello, my name is Ricky from Miami. I'm a 17-year vet. My wife is a teacher. She's been a teacher for 10 years in the Miami-Dade County area. I have 3 kids, one at the university level, one at the high school level, one in the elementary school level. And I'm appalled by the lack of leadership. Opening up schools is absolutely ridiculous. And it's going to force people like my wife to step out of the arena of education.
You can tell us what you're thinking about school reopening next month. You can find us right now on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Finally, in the roundup this week, hospitals are facing an influx of COVID-19 patients across South Florida. Last week, we spoke with Nikki Mason about her experience as a nurse. She works at a hospital in the Fort Lauderdale area.
Well, we don't know what we're going to be, what floor we're going to be on until we walk in the door. So I never know from one day to the next. So I'm always prepared as if I'm going to be on the COVID floor. We get our temperature taken in the morning when we arrive to work. The policy here is that they take our temperature. If we have a fever for any reason, we have to go back to our car. I'm hoping that by December and January, we're COVID-free.
We want to hear more stories from healthcare workers. WLRN is teaming up with our sister station in Orlando. If you or someone you know works at a hospital, nursing home, or other healthcare facility, we'd like to hear their experiences. Share them with us. You can find more details on the WLRN Facebook page and on our Twitter and Instagram feeds. You can also send us a text, 786-677-0767. Text 786-677-0767. And of course, you can stay up to date with the latest coronavirus news in South Florida by signing up for our email newsletter, wlrn.us/signup. wlrn.us/signup. And that'll do it for our program this week. The South Florida Roundup is produced by Alexander Gonzalez. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Lance Dixon is our digital editor. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. The director of radio programming is Jason Zabka. The director of radio operations and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. Phones are answered by Denise Royal. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for calling, listening, and supporting WLRN. The program is made possible by Willie the Bee Man, Bee Removal Specialist.